What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of Bridgestone tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation that comes to your home or office. Shop Bridgestone Tires at TireRack.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to another Commission podcast. This is for 2008's Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, a web release.
This will be the first musical podcast we've ever done.
But will not be the last.
We have constructed several songs for this podcast.
We have?
Yeah.
No, podcast I have. Podcast musical, okay.
In my bathroom, in the shower mostly, singing about how great NPH and Nathan Fillion are. That'll be
while
at the
you're
end.
Sudsing your naked body. I like where this is going.
Yeah, so you have that to look forward to at the end of the podcast.
So this was directed by Joss Whedon. It was born during the writer's strike as a creative outlet for some of his personal friends. He recruited all of his family, Joss, Zach, Jed. Or so Joss is his evil clone. Josh Whedon, the evil clone of Joss. And Jed's wife, Marissa. Who also plays the third groupie, or maybe the second groupie, for Captain Hammer. Mm-hmm. This was commissioned by Tyler Shumway, all-around great guy. Previously commissioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. We have him to thank for this, and I'm going to let him introduce this work. There's nothing quite like Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. For the first 5 minutes or so, you think it's just a funny little YouTube video with Neil Patrick Harris. Then my freeze ray starts, and you realize it's a full-on musical with Felicia Day, that guy from Big Bang Theory, and Nathan Fillion. Like I mentioned in my Buffy commission, Joss Whedon studied musical theater before he went into film, and this seems like the natural evolution from the Buffy musical episode. He learned important lessons from the Buffy musical. Wisely, he decided to bring in his brother Jed's wife Marissa, to help compose the music. He was able to cast people that he knew were good singers, and since this is a web series, he had complete creative freedom. While I personally love the Buffy musical more, I recognize Dr. Horrible is objectively better in pretty much every way, but also maybe not a fair comparison, since the Buffy musical has over 5 seasons to develop the characters and build emotional stakes. It's actually pretty impressive Dr. Horrible is able to pack such an emotional punch in only 45 minutes. He also has a litany of things he wants us to talk about, but I thought maybe we would see what we came up with, stream of consciousness style for a bit.
First of all, who is the person from the Big Bang Theory?
Moist.
Oh, okay, yeah, sure. All right, I forgot he even existed.
Uh-huh.
Such a minor part in this, but yes.
Uh-huh. He, there's also a couple people that I recognized without, or that I recognized in my research, like the Joss, Jed, and Zach are the horse heralds, I'm going to call them.
Yeah.
Of Bad Horse.
The horse chorus?
Yeah, the horse chorus. I remember the first time seeing this, I thought... So I am predisposed to like musicals. I don't know why, but I've seen a bunch. I've seen a bunch of them, and I like the kind of magical realism that they introduce, and... the fact that tone and feeling and music is as important as like dialogue, or maybe even more important as set and construction and costuming and all that. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was really good, and also had us a lot of Joss Whedon-y stuff. Like the sense of humor is very Joss Whedon-y. The dialogue is very Joss Whedon-y. It stars a lot of Joss Whedon favorites, such as Nathan Fillion. But also has some of the problems I've become aware of his work, which is for the majority, it seems like he writes most of his characters as middle year teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's where they're always kind of emotionally and mentally stuck with exception. And also they can like evolve on the spot when necessary, like when he needs them to have a mature adult scene, he just writes them having that shift. Like it's mm-hmm. almost like all of his characters are aware that they're playing characters through the Avengers, through Buffy, and then when things get real, they kind of become real people, and then that facade is disposed of once, you know, the tragedy de jure is dispensed with.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it puts a different description on what I was generalizing in my head as sort of flimsy characters.
That's not to say they're not great characters.
Right. They're enjoyable to watch, certainly.
Yeah, they're entertaining.
But I think for the most part, they're very shallow.
Yeah. And it's like, I wonder what it would be like, and maybe I'm just ignorant of enough of his work, maybe gotten this in Dollhouse or Buffy or something, but I would like to see him write what he thinks is an adult relationship between a man or a woman, or a man and man, and woman, in fact. Because I always see this, like, weird junior high, early high school flailing. Even my biggest problem with Firefly is Mal Reynolds is emotionally 13 anytime there's a woman that he likes that enters the frame of the camera. Mm-hmm. And that can be entertaining, but like it kind of becomes one note, and I found that Dr. Horrible is essentially that same character too.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that. I don't necessarily think he needs to write for everyone though. I think if he has a lane and he wants to stay in it,
yeah,
that's cool with me. Like he just has to expect people to outgrow his work at some point.
I mean, like I said, for a summer blockbuster type movie, I'm not out on that ride, but mm-hmm. I would like to see him. Although, you know, I've also seen him, you know, the last thing I saw him do, like slumming between projects, he did a black and white version of a Much Ado About Nothing that he shot at his house. And that was awesome. But then again, that's Shakespeare. So,
Those characters are not shallow.
Those characters, well, I mean, some of them are. It is a little comical farce, but it does have a little bit of gravitas that a lot of his work seems to.
And I think, like, you know, there is a less than shallow character in this, and I think it's Dr. Horrible.
Okay.
I think Dr. Horrible is written a little bit deeper than the other two characters.
Because I've seen Dr. Horrible a bunch. I watched it three times. I watched it twice. I watched it once just for the hell of it because I thought it would be fun. Then I watched another to take notes. And then my son came to work with me today. And he was wanting to know what I was working because I was listening to the commentary track when I picked him up last night on my way to work. And he was like, what is this? And I'm like, oh, it's a commentary track for Dr. Horrible. Long story short, I sat him down and had him watch it in the office while I was busy finishing up my research. And I was going to continue to listen to the commentary, but I got wrapped up in watching it again. And I was watching him watch it and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I was thinking during the rewatches, how many different ways you can interpret this. Mm. Because there's one way to interpret it is Dr. Horrible was barking up the wrong tree the entire time with Penny.
Sure.
And what he really needed to do to achieve his life's dream was to stop worrying about women and work on himself and achieve his objectives, which he does.
Uh-huh.
Which he does.
He does.
He shows the city as heartless, that their hero is just a pretty shell. And that he has the right to rule people as sheep, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's one way to interpret it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that he needs to give up on women. I think maybe he just needs to give up on Penny because Penny is not compatible with his life's view.
Yeah,
like he is the ever pessimist. She is the ever optimist, right? Like,
yeah,
they're approaching the problem that they see in two polarly opposite ways.
And I feel like on some level he knows, like he can't ever be honest with Penny because there's a couple times where he comes like really close, like he confesses that he idolizes Bad Horse,
uh-huh.
Which every time they say his nickname, the Thoroughbred of Sin, it cracks me up.
Yeah,
or he rules the League of Evil with an iron hoof.
When he says I met Gandhi, it just it makes it even funnier.
No, but
sure,
he's like
that
always
could be his nickname.
He can't be like even honest about not liking laundry,
right?
You know, he doesn't have Anakin Skywalker level of honesty with women, where you know he can he can openly bitch about sand and killing Jawas and sand people.
Yep.
I guess that's what I'm. I shouldn't say give up on women, but certainly it's just that's the high school thing, right? You see a woman you are hot for her, and then she's suddenly the girl of your dreams. Sure. You don't know anything about her. She knows nothing about you, but you've got this entire one-sided relationship you've carried on in her head. It's kind of like a cautionary friend zone story. Like, don't do that. Don't put yourself there.
And the idea that you should change yourself to impress or please this person, when in fact that person is probably just not right for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally. I mean, that's what Dr. Horrible is doing.
I will say the third time I rewatched, I kind of caught Felicia Day's character, Penny, doing a little bit of that with Billy. Because I feel like that maybe there was a little bit of chemistry there. And that she was like softening some of her answers or some of her responses to her to try to appeal to him. And I wonder if there is a... Because there's always been talk about the sequel, right? And an interesting sequel would be like Penny's sing-along blog to see that she's like struggling with thoughts of like this, you know, helping people out is just a face she puts on the world. And she secretly thinks it's terrible and it's bad and it needs to be ruled with an iron hoof or something like that. Like,
yeah, what would you even call that? It's not a prequel. It's not a sequel. It would be happening like simultaneously, right?
Because she's dead, right? Is there...
I assume she's dead. Is she dead? She's dead.
Well, I mean, in my mind, I was thinking, like, what if that you build up to the climax and then somehow she gets she's not actually dead or she gets resurrected by some other supervillain?
Okay, yeah.
The
power of love. Hammer comes in and busts into the hospital.
There you
and
go. But it turns out she's fully evil.
Okay.
I thought that would be an interesting way to go because I kept on seeing that where maybe there was a – and it could be just that I watched it a bunch of times over the course of several days and I was trying to figure out new angles for it. But I kind of thought that in between the lines maybe she was a bit – because she's got this – well, because the other way to interpret it is they've had very similar stories that they're kind of losers in life and they're outcasts and they're lonely and they're sad and she turns to – humanitarian and you know goals and positivism and throws herself into the pitying the city where he decides that he wants to royally rule some sort of anarchy situation.
He wants to disrupt the status quo, I guess.
Yeah,
I feel like they both have this idea that something is wrong and needs to be changed, and they just approach it from different angles.
Yeah,
and there it's kind of a similar goal with different means.
And there's also like the fact that Dr. Horrible is aware on some level that he's kind of campy. Like, you know, when his fake arch nemesis suggests meeting in a park and throwing down, he's like, you know, it's like he gives a list of reasons why he doesn't really want to fight with him. And he's like, plus there's kids in that park. And then when Bad Horse, that's the thing, he's not even Evil Horse, he's just Bad Horse. When he finally gets his message saying, look, if you want to get in the League of Evil, you're going to have to kill somebody. Like, Dr. Horrible really struggles with that because there's nothing, like, elegant or interesting about that.
Yeah.
He's like a classic, he's like a Batman villain, I guess, that has to have some style to it, where Bad Horse is just he's a terrorist.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the defining features of him. You know, he doesn't want to kill anybody. And then he's kind of forced to do, you know, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, so he decides he's got to kill to get into this evil League of Evil. And, you know, he's prepared to kill Hammer, I guess, at that point.
Yeah. Well, plus I think that's the Brand New Day song is the fact that, like, okay, if I have to kill somebody, I think I can easily do this guy because he's such a douchebag.
He probably deserves it, honestly. Like, yeah, he's a hero, but he's such an asshole.
He's not even really a hero. Like, he's just a big, strong guy
who does things that happen to align with what people might think of a hero.
Yeah, like, he almost kills a whole bunch of civilians in the beginning.
Yep.
And, you know, he clearly is not also in it for the right reasons.
Of course, yeah.
Like, he's betting Penny for his own amusement to fuck with Dr. Horrible more than he's attracted to her.
For sure.
And, like, I also thought it was interesting how she's kind of conflicted, how that she thought, you know, when she first met Captain.
Yeah.
I wanted just no disrespect, not Mr., not Doc. When he met Captain Hammer, she thought he was, like, shallow and kind of cheesy. And then he now kind of puts a charm on her and helps her with the homeless shelter. And then she thinks he's kind of awesome. But then you could tell in the third act that she's kind of like maybe he is actually what I thought he was in the beginning.
Yeah.
And Billy is my true friend. But
yeah, I can't help but think that this doesn't really kick into gear until Hammer shows up. Like, I know Nathan Fillion is awesome. Like, I like him in Firefly. Mm-hmm. I think it's real unfortunate that he kind of got stuck in a castle hole, though he does a whole bunch of stuff. But it's mostly, like, one-off TV things and video mm-hmm. game voices. Mm-hmm. But I think he has a lot more potential. He's by far the best thing in Destiny. Okay, sure. Does he do Ghost? Is that
no? He does Cade Six, the hunter, whatever Vanguard leader. Which that's a video game loaded with voice talent. You got Lieutenant, what was it his name from The Wire? Oh my God, Lieutenant Daniels. You got Zoe from Firefly.
You had Peter Dinklage.
They got rid of him because he was too expensive to bring back. But you got like a lot of really top tier talent.
But I mean, it really kicks up a notch when Nathan Fillion shows up. I feel like the acting, you know, NPH is great in the blog style stuff, but I feel like when they're acting on screen together, it's dynamite.
Huh?
It's just like really, really intricate comedy.
Yeah.
Like especially when they do these like multiple lyric lines for this single song.
Yeah.
They're all kind of singing over each other and about what the other people are singing about. And it's,
that's why
I don't know. It's really genius.
That's my favorite part of musicals. But there's also, I was going to sit you down and watch this Key and Peele skit called One at a Time.
Oh boy.
Which is essentially because it gets really crazy in some stuff like Les Miserables, mm-hmm. where like there's four different threads of people singing to take out an act or introduce an act. And I can't remember if it's Key or Peele that's in the middle of it, and they're just the chorus is like one at a time because it's like there's two people singing, it's a guy and a girl, and then like the villain comes in, starts singing, he's like, "What the hell are you doing in here?" And then the captain of the guard comes in, he's like, "Oh my god!" And then the fucking chorus joins in, he's like, "I can't even understand what the hell anyone's saying anymore."
Yep.
But that's part of the musical. Like, you're not supposed to get it all in the first experience,
right?
You're supposed to get the feelings and then analyze the lyrics and let them get the earworms in your head. And figure out all the subtleties later.
And I like that this is so short because it gives you opportunity to do that. I've seen this probably 3 or 4 times now.
Yeah.
You on the second and third viewings, you start to get more of what they're saying and, mm-hmm. and what it means.
Yeah, no. I remember clearly when Nathan, because I didn't know anything about this. I know one of the things Shum wanted us to talk about is her history with it.
Yeah.
And my history was I had an ex-girlfriend show up with the Blu-ray. Maybe it's a DVD, and she was a big Buffy fan, and she had previously made me watch the first season of Buffy, and that was okay. I don't want to piss off Shum too much, but, you know, like, I don't have the history of Buffy that he does. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, you know, shows up at the Dr. Horrible sing-along blog, and I'm like, okay, well, I like Neil Patrick Harris. I don't really like Felicia Day, but whatever. Mm-hmm. And then Nathan Fillion jumps on the van. I'm like, oh, get the fuck out of here. This is awesome.
Yeah, and that scene where they're battling and he's you know, slamming his head while smiling so smarmily
with the girl,
at Felicia Day, and he's slamming his head on the hood. I don't know. The way like all three of them interact, I don't like Felicia Day like at all. I've only seen her in a few things. The Guild like tops my list of holy shit, I don't like this.
Well, here's the thing, like I don't even know that I don't like her so much as I really hated the Guild.
Yeah, same here. Okay, that's fair.
But that's this,
I think she's good.
And I feel like a single project can really leave a bad taste in your mouth with somebody. It's like if I watched Jack Gleason, the kid that played Joffrey, in like a romantic comedy, I would like you'd spend the first act or two just hating him on sight.
Yeah,
and it's even funny because like when he's in the first Batman, he's the gutter rat kid in the bad part of Gotham that Rachel goes and saves when they're gassing everything.
Wow.
And okay. I'm like, just let him get trampled.
Yeah.
This goes nowhere good, Rachel. Let the insane criminals get him.
She's not given a ton of good material in this, though. I feel like she's like the least written of all the characters.
Well, and I think that's probably deliberate because she's
a MacGuffin, basically.
Yeah,
like,
she is Dr. Horrible's totem of lust.
Yeah.
It's
unfortunate.
Because
I do think she's good despite the flimsy or thin writing for her character.
Oh, yeah. And she's got a better than I expected voice.
Yeah.
And also, I feel like that her and Neil Patrick Harris have a lot of chemistry. Like, there's a couple fantasy sequences where they're allowed to just, like, dance together and be cute together. And they're, like, really super cute together.
I don't know that Neil Patrick Harris would have no chemistry with anybody.
He is very charismatic and charming.
Yeah, I think he can just turn it on.
And in fact, that's one of the other criticisms I have, is that it's somewhat unbelievable that he's a social loser. Like, he can affect right. all the ticks he wants and, like, yeah. be his mumble mouth, and but he's just still, he's really talented and expressive and an interesting guy.
It's funny that you mentioned the ticks, because I kept noticing the stuff he's doing with his eyes. Like, uh-huh. nobody does better work with their eyelids than NPH.
Right.
He's doing all sorts of crazy stuff, and I couldn't tell...
How the goggles push his forehead down to give him like a wrinkly Klingon head.
Right.
That was like, it gives him a more brutish look when he's got those on.
Yeah, I think about his career and, like, you know, he was Doogie Howser way back in the day in the late 80s, early 90s. Then he kind of went off the map for a long time and was doing like one-off TV things, mm-hmm. Like in stupid shows like Murder, She Wrote or whatever.
Like, right. He also had, like, I guess unbeknownst to a lot of people, he had a fairly successful Broadway career.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, he's won a Tony Award.
Culminating in, wasn't he in the Hedwig?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
a couple
That's
years
That's
what
back? He won the Tony for.
Okay, gotcha. Because yeah. he had worked his way up to that. And his big, I guess his big break...
Harold and Kumar go to White Castle.
But was that his big break, or was that just like, oh my God, Doogie Howser is a kind of like sociopathic stoner?
Well, that's when he went William Shatner, honestly. Mm. Like when he satirized his own persona.
Right. Right.
Which I think was like a super smart thing for him to do. And now he's come back just as like the super smooth guy, right?
Yeah, like he got cast as Barney Stinson, yeah. in How I Met Your Mother, and then that's like he's been permanently famous since then.
Right. Right.
Was Dr. Horrible... Oh, he was also in Starship Troopers.
He was.
Was Dr. Horrible pre How I Met Your Mother, or was it in the middle of How I Met Your Mother?
How I Met Your Mother, I don't know. I know Harold Kumar Go to White Castle was like 4 years
oh,
before
yeah.
this.
I just looked it up, and yeah, he was on How I Met Your Mother in the glory days. It debuted in 2005, so two, 3 years under his belt there before Dr. Horrible came along.
Yeah, I mean, both of these guys, Nathan Fillion and Neil Patrick Harris, kind of got stuck in, like, How I Met Your Mother is not bad. It's a pretty good show.
It did run out of steam like most network shows do.
But... Yeah, and it never really caught fire with me, personally. No.
I did like the very early. I was a pretty big fan the first couple of years.
Yeah.
And then it was easy for me to just stop watching it.
Yeah, yeah. It had a very, like, Friends vibe to it, honestly.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
that over again, which
yeah.
didn't interest me very much. But, I mean, he's good in it. It was a super popular show. But I hate when actors that I like get stuck in multi-year contracts for things that I don't care about.
Right.
You know? Like, well, Nathan Fillion and NPH have both done that.
But, like, I feel like if you had asked me 10 years ago mm-hmm. who would have had the bigger career, been more famous, more marketable, I would have said, oh, no, you know, Nathan Fillion.
Yeah.
Nathan Fillion's like one action movie or
yeah.
science fiction movie away from being a breakout star, because he's like he could possibly be the next Harrison Ford.
Yeah, totally.
And he just never has. And I don't know yeah. that's entire – like I honestly don't – I don't know what the hell to make of it. I don't know, because if you'd have told me that Neil Patrick Harris is more famous than Nathan Fillion 10 years from Dr. Horrible, I'd been like, no fucking way.
I wonder if it's just these guys have one gear.
Could be.
Because, I mean, I've never seen Nathan Fillion in anything where he's not Nathan Fillion.
Yeah.
Same for NPH, really.
Yeah. I mean,
so maybe they just can't. They don't have the range that they need to be like big action heroes or whatever.
Yeah,
but I mean, you look at what
how much range do you need to be a big action
right,
hero?
Right, like look what
what's
Jason
his face Statham,
with Guardians of the Galaxy, what he's doing.
Chris, yeah.
Like he's just him.
Yeah,
it's not like he's
right.
stretching at all. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Nathan Fillion totally could have been that guy.
Right, like Chris. I mean, I don't know. Chris Pine's got a couple extra dimensions to him.
Yeah,
but
he does.
I don't. And that's the other thing is like, have I not seen Nathan Fillion have more range because everyone wants him to be
right.
Nathan Fillion, or is he just got that one range? Like, I guess I would suspect that he probably has more range. It's just like if you cast Nathan Fillion, why the hell would you want him to do anything but be Nathan Fillion in that role?
Yeah.
Like, you know, they need like, Paul Thomas Anderson to cast right. him in some kind of crazy ass Adam Sandler thing, like Punch Drunk Love, and then we can see what he's really capable of.
And I know NPH has another gear, obviously, if you sure. won a Tony Award for playing a transgender rock and roll star.
Like, right.
He's got another gear. So.
But that's kind of a piece, though, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. like a really broad, campy kind of performance, so... yeah, I don't know.
I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about the musical itself, but
yeah.
I know he won a Tony for it, and I don't know. I assume he has another gear.
Yeah. I mean, he's like I said, the guy's super talented. I just don't I don't know why I guess he's the biggest of the stars in the show. Excepting maybe the Whedon brothers, but they don't get in front of the camera very often. And that's just surprising to me, the fact that they're not all collectively more famous. And that Neil Patrick Harris is the more famous of the two.
I guess this did kind of, Felicia Day was on her way to becoming cemented in like nerd culture mm-hmm. as an icon. But I think this put Nathan Fillion and NPH more on the map than they were before.
More than Firefly?
I think so. I mean,
maybe Neil Patrick Harris, although
certainly him.
Doogie Howser. Like, I remember growing up, like, I was kind of right. I idolized Doogie Howser. Like, I was a big
child
fan.
Genius doctor. Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Sure, sure. Wasn't yeah. Yeah.
There's plenty to idolize there.
Yeah. I've always been a bit of a handful, but I feel like Nathan Fillion, like Firefly, the brown coat. Legions, like he was already solidly cemented in that geek culture, and he just keeps.
He was,
maybe he just likes that. Maybe that's the gear he likes to operate in. Because if you look at his choices and getting into the video, or though maybe that's the stuff they offer him. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows?
But Felicia Day. So like, I really, really have an intense, visceral dislike of the guild and that kind of lifestyle that mm-hmm. it both. Pokes fun of and also excuses.
Yeah.
But I have you seen any of the new Mystery Science Theater 3000s?
No.
Because she's not a bad evil Forrester type in that. Like her and Patton Oswalt, I think they're they're actually professional actors, and all the other Forresters have been just like essentially staff writers on Mystery Science Theater to put on a lab coat.
Right.
So I guess Patton Oswalt and her being funnier than those people should not surprise me. Mm-hmm. But she's actually pretty good. I like her quite a bit in the new Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah. I know she has talent. I just get hung up on the guild.
Yeah. And she does have an odd kind of squirrely little chemistry. Nathan Fillion mm-hmm. calls her a monkey face in the commentary. And he's not wrong. I'd go with more of a rabbit face.
Yeah, yeah, rabbit monkey combo.
Yeah, like Goat Boy and Saturday Night Live. She's mm-hmm. rabbit girl.
Okay. I could see that. What is your favorite song in this one?
Brand New Day.
Brand New Day, huh?
Yeah. I like the chunky guitar riffs. I like
yeah.
I also like. I think that's a song where there's like a montage of Captain Hammer giving Dr. Horrible a four season beatdown.
Uh huh.
Like starts off in spring and keeps on going through summer, and then sure enough, there's Santa Claus ringing the bell and collecting the red pot full of money, and he's helicoptering him.
Right.
I like that. I like that a lot.
I think mine's probably A Man's Got to Do,
yeah.
just because of the intricacy of it,
and it's the introduction of Hammer.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one.
I will say that even though it's a super low budget, this was all filmed for under $200,000. There was a lot of really kind of cool framing devices. My favorite one is when they're in the laundromat and he's talking about the stop time, mm-hmm. Where everyone like opens those circular doors and it kind of frames them in like a scoping device. I'm like, that's pretty fucking clever.
Yeah. I mean,
you show up at an actual laundromat, close it down for the day, and then it's like, what can I do here? And like, he's got the Joss Whedon, among other things, has a really good eye for that stuff.
He does, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about that when we did the Firefly podcast. Mm-hmm. Just kind of his framing of stuff is really, really good.
Mm-hmm. And interesting. Like, yeah. And there's not a lot of people. Well, I mean, I think it's something worth taking for granted because 10, 15 years into the golden age of television, like, you know, this is stuff very self-referential, but it's something I try not to take for granted, the fact that stuff like Breaking Bad and interesting camera angles and interesting ways of looking at things and interesting elevations and shots and approaches and how it makes you feel things and introduces the space and frames people. And I try not to take that for granted. And Dr. Horrible is like chock full of it in 45 minutes.
Yeah, if I were a better critic, I would talk about shot composition and Joss Whedon's way of doing it, but I'm not, right. So I won't.
Right. The other thing is like I like about Brand New Day is I like the reprise at the end where he dons his ultimate red evil outfit and he walks into Bad Horse's inner council. Yeah, I just like that song a lot. It's the most cranked up version of all the songs.
Yeah.
Although I think my single favorite moment, and I don't even fully understand. I want to ask you what it means, but when Captain Hammer recovers from the freeze ray and punches Dr. Horrible in the face, and he gets up and he goes, "Wah!" and he gives him the finger.
Uh-huh.
What does that? What?
I think he's mad about being frozen. I really don't know.
Behold the whole why. Like I don't.
Is that the final note of the song he was singing?
Actually might be right that he got frozen in mid sentence and he just comes out of it like ta-da.
Yeah.
It's like the.
I'm not sure.
Okay, because that's like I don't know because I don't know why I like it. I can't articulate it. But Nathan Fillion punching some dude, going right into this big number a cappella style, and flipping the guys off with his big rubber gloves.
Yeah,
super funny.
Captain Hammer is the worst though. I think of all the people here, he's right up there with Dr. Horrible as far as being just a shit to everybody, because he clearly has just as much, he's more casual about his hate, mm-hmm. but he has just as much disdain for people. I mean,
oh yeah,
that song about everybody's a hero,
right,
is ridiculous.
Yeah.
The way he's talking to the homeless.
I love when he goes, "I hate the homeless." And he flips over his card, "Less problem or right. in this city." Like, yeah, he's terrible. He's bad. He's like, he reminds me a lot of Archer.
Uh-huh.
You know, where like he's like very good at what he does, but he's all in it for the wrong reasons and
is
completely shallow and superficial and hates everybody around him, doesn't respect anyone.
I think one of my favorite lines in the whole thing is when he's doing his song and he says something about it's not enough to bash in heads, you also have to bash in minds.
Yeah.
And then he's talking about bashing in the slums. And
uh-huh.
I don't know. It's really hilarious.
Yeah. What else we want to talk about? Because some of the stuff I think that we're naturally going to start talking about is stuff that Shum wanted to ask us anyway.
Uh-huh.
So let us get into that. You want to know our history of Dr. Horrible.
Oh.
Did you see Dr. Horrible before me or did...
I think I saw it about the time it came out, or
okay.
maybe when it came out.
Okay, so
yeah, it was real
you
early.
Saw it before me.
Huh, okay.
Because I think when I saw it, there's one of those phases we were living together, and I kind of see you in the room, but that could just be me mixing up hundreds of different memories at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was introduced to an ex-girlfriend who was a huge Joss Whedon fan. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like, Dr. Horrible, like he was known for like what, Buffy, Dollhouse, and Firefly? But
yep.
he hadn't gotten like a really big gig. He hadn't directed the Avengers or anything like that. He hadn't been attached to any high profile projects like that. Mm-hmm. So, funniest moment, best joke. We talked about this a lot. There's a ton. Like, I really like the joke about double dating.
Yep.
With moist bait and switch. It's like, yeah, I thought I was going to end up with bait, but you know, all the different jokes about Bad Horse and the fact that I think Bad Horse is just a really good joke because that's just like a terrible, terrible name. But he rules the League of Evil with the Iron Hoof, and then you meet him at the end, and he's just a horse. He's just a bad horse.
Yep.
I liked Patrick Harris wearing a mustache in the back when he's
pouring
doing
the
worst. He's doing the worst job pouring soup into the homeless people's bowls.
Yep.
I like the why moment is really, really funny. The hammer's my penis is classic. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if that was an improv, an ad lib.
Maybe so. I'm not sure, though, because in the commentary stuff, there's a line from Zach about how Joss took out a bunch of his jokes, and one of them is where Penny says, "Penny is my pussy," which I thought is a pretty good joke to mirror Hammer's penis joke.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah. So maybe that was written.
Okay. It could be. It could be. I like Neil Patrick Harris's Grinch face that he puts on during the Brand New Day song.
When he comes back in at the beginning of Act 2 and he says, "Well, Captain Hammer and the cops were waiting for me and he threw a car at me."
Yeah.
Apparently they watch my blog.
Right,
yeah.
That's pretty good. Uh-huh. how tone deaf the anchors are in this city, the news anchors, boy. Where they're like, oh, it's a good day to be homeless. It certainly is. Like, right. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And the fact that, like, that kind of, like, I started thinking about, like, is this like a Gotham-style city that doesn't deserve to be saved? Like, maybe Dr. Horrible has a point.
Could be.
Because these people have died. Because that's the thing is, like, Captain Hammer does not bury his disdain and how kind of terrible as a human being he is very deep. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's capable of that. And yet the people still eating up, it's like there was, when he was doing his Everyone's a Hero, there wasn't a dawning realization that they've thrown their weight behind a jackass. Everyone was still like, oh my God, yeah, this guy's the best. And it wasn't until Dr. Horrible killed him, or I guess bested him in combat and killed his girlfriend, that the city started to embrace him as the new, you know, celeb de jour.
Yeah, so, I mean, he sidelined Captain Hammer, right?
Yeah.
Like, Captain Hammer trades in good looks and charm. Mm-hmm. That is why people
and the fact
follow
he's,
and like
he's
Captain
super
Hammer.
Strong and invulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, that helps. But mostly it's about the good looks and charm, right?
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, he's sidelined after the freeze ray thing and Penny's dead. Now he's in therapy. I thought that was pretty funny. Like, he feels pain for the first time, runs off, goes and gets counseling.
Like, yeah, this
Dr. Horrible's
like his
out there.
Literally first bad experience he's ever had.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Also, that's like a bit of a. The fact that Penny's the first woman he slept with more than once.
Uh huh.
Like, says a lot about him.
Hilarious jokes in there. Like, when he's saying, so they say it's better the second time. You get to do
the weird stuff.
And then the groupies pop out and say, we do the weird stuff.
There's a lot of really funny jokes with the groupies, too. Like, my personal favorite is they're like how into Captain Hammer they are.
Mm-hmm.
And then they talk about Penny and they say, oh, she says that she helps with the homeless and she doesn't eat meat. And then they're like, we have a problem with her. Like, the fact that they hate his girlfriend. That's very groupie fan thing to do.
Yeah,
that might be all of the jokes actually in the show.
No, I think there are a lot.
We were talking about favorite song. What'd you say yours one is? A Man's Gotta Do?
Man's Gotta Do, yep.
Mine's The Brand New Day. Mm-hmm.
I think there's something.
Do you have a least favorite? Because I felt slipping. Slipping always kind of like, I appreciate what they're doing there, but like there's something about the cadence and everything that I don't like.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the songs. Let's see. I really like my freeze ray. That one's good.
Penny's song's not. I don't like either. But I hesitate to throw that in there because I just have a visceral of Felicia Day.
I think So They Say is pretty bad. Like when they get the movers singing.
Those people
can't sing. Who do you think is the best singer out of the group?
Oh, Neil Patrick Harris.
Okay, good.
He kind of demonstrates his impressive range in the commentary more than anything, where
he
gets his own song and he says as low as he wants, as high as he wants, and I mean he's got to be the best singer.
I would say he's probably the most trained as well.
Well, right. It would be a shock if he wasn't.
Yeah.
But I think Felicia Day is no one's bad.
No.
Like they're like Sarah Michelle Gellar was a little cover your eyes bad in the Buffy stuff.
A bit, yeah.
But
I think Felicia Day is second best, and I think Nathan Fillion is not too far behind, but definitely
he's not bad.
Third.
But I don't think he gets out of an octave range.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're if he's bad, they're playing to his strengths.
You know who
smart.
I think is the best?
Who
is the Asian groupie? And we'll talk more about this in a bit. But
okay,
she's actually really good.
That's Jed's wife.
Yeah,
and she's also the co-writer of the thing.
And she can really belt it out.
Which
you hear in the commentary. I don't know when we want to get to that, but
Sean says his favorite is probably My Eyes, which is the duet between Billy and Penny during their date with Captain Hammer in Act 2.
Yeah, that's a pretty good one too.
He's got some fun facts. The news anchors in Act 3 are played by Marty Noxon and Dave Fury, who were both writers for Buffy and appeared in a musical episode as Parking Ticket Lady and Mustard Stain Guy, which I remember from the podcast.
Huh.
If you look closely, you can spot Sarah Michelle Gellar wearing a dark wig and sunglasses sitting next to the groupie during Everyone's a Hero. The Evil League of Evil consists of Professor Normal, Fake Thomas Jefferson, Tie-Dye, Dead Bowie, Furry Laika, Snakebite, and Bad Horse. Now, I don't know who, like, Fake Thomas Jefferson, I know mm-hmm. who that is. Dead Bowie, definitely know who that is. The other, and Bad Horse, obviously I know who that is. I guess Snakebite is the guy who's got the, like, some kind of metal apparatus on his jaw. But Furry Laika and Tie-Dye and Professor Normal, I can't even picture.
Professor Normal. He's probably a lot like Giamatti Man, you know? He's so average, you don't even notice him.
Right, right. Then you want us to talk about the commentary, which I didn't even know this existed until he sent it in. So I had to look it up. There's a playlist on YouTube that had them all. And because I couldn't find, I don't know if she gave me that Blu-ray or she's brought over to my house to watch it, because I kind of was hunting it up because I hear that that's an extra feature on it. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find it anywhere. But he says his favorites are Ninja Ropes, Nobody's Asian in the Movies, and Heartbroken. I thought this was a really good idea for commentary, too, the fact that it's also a musical.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they had a lot of time on their hands during the writer's strike.
No kidding.
Yeah,
I think my favorite song off of that is definitely Heartbroken. That's a really good song, and I like the topic, how, you know, essentially Joss Whedon is almost like lamenting the fandom that he's built around his works in a way.
Right.
Like, he has to go and do all these interviews and explain every single detail of it to people who want to know the answers to these questions. And it's awesome, but it probably also sucks, right, as an artist?
Well, but he doesn't have to.
No, but that's what he's kind of cultivated, you know?
I guess that's true.
Like, that's kind of the fandom he dipped his toes into, and when he did that, he sort of sealed his own fate in a way.
Right, right.
And I don't know how much of that I'm putting on it or how much of that he's putting in it, but...
Yeah, and also it's like some of those things that you, like, maybe they don't scale well.
Hmm.
Like, when you have a very small cult following, the, you know, obsessive details and... people finding all the Easter eggs and you being able to, like, you know, interact with people. But then when you're starting to do stuff that's bigger and higher profile and people are really obsessing over in a much wider swath of humanity, and it just becomes too much.
Yeah. They pick it apart.
And then, but then it's like, we're like, if you show up at Comic-Con, it's like, look, I'm just gonna let my art stand on its own. Then people are like, oh, Joss Whedon, he's too big. We, you know, I guess I feel him on that.
And I know there's like, I seem to recall something around that time where, you know, he's been at Comic-Con and he started to get a little fed up with this whole thing. But I don't remember it well enough to talk about it intelligently.
Yeah, and I also don't know, because, like, I remember the very first time I heard about, like, a backlash around Comic-Con was around, like, the Twilight stuff.
Twilight?
Yeah, like the Twilight fans are ruining Twilight because they would do things like two or three panels before a Twilight panel take up seats.
Yeah.
And they had to, like, change things. Like, now every time the people got out, like, every time a theater is dismissed, they had to clear the whole theater out because they didn't want... like, because that must be a real bummer if you're a creator and you're wanting to connect your fans and 80% of it's Twilight people waiting to see, like, the werewolf boy come up and say something for 5 minutes, you know? Like, that's got to really be a shitty... But I also was like, some of that might just be that they're inclined to hate the Twilight fans because they just don't belong there.
Mm.
And I feel like that's kind of like... this is that 10 years ago is around the time where Comic-Con stopped being like a really geeky, nerdy thing and started being taken over by corporations and
it's mainstream.
Yeah, it's just like it become like a weird clearinghouse for all movies and television shows and whether they have a geek angle or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I, you know, it's podcasts like this that make me wish I was more of an expert on, like, you know, the inside kind of stuff in Hollywood. Because I know, like I said, that there was some kind of thing around Joss Whedon and Comic-Con, but I don't remember what it was. And there are people out there who know exactly what it was.
I guess I was surprised with the commentary to find out how kind of morose, I guess, they're... And I get it. I don't know why I want to say that that's a little bit more accurate than the other portrayals, because obviously... Nathan Fillion, I don't believe, is a giant, unself-aware asshole as he is in the commentary, and that, you know, all these guys are self-obsessed. So, like, they're probably playing that up. But I guess I was shocked to the extent that Joss seems like he's a bit of a, like, a morbid kind of, cynical, negative guy.
Hmm. Just, like, specifically that song, or...
Well, it's just like they're...
just the stuff in general.
Whereas, like, you know, when they're... I mean, I know this is a joke when they're like, you know, explain the motive, like, where did the idea come for coming up with a musical? And he's like, pain. And then, like, it's like several times his brothers are cutting him off about, like, dwelling on some kind of negative aspect of creativity. And, like, it just feels like that's the tone, like that Joss has got this storm cloud over his head that everybody else is trying to chase away. But again, I don't know why I think that's an accurate depiction of him. It could just be a funny way to view this particular work, that this guy's got this bright and sunny musical where a girl gets murdered and secretly he's just like just really depressed, cynical character.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably playing a character as much as Nathan Fillion or NPH or Felicia Day.
Yeah. I also thought, so is Jed's wife Maureen? She's
Maurice.
Maurice, really?
Mm-hmm.
I always say if Maurice is like a dude's name.
Yeah, it sounds like a really old dude's name.
Yeah. Like he was in the original
Marissa.
Hollywood.
Marissa.
Okay, that's better.
Maurice
was part of the first Hollywood writer strike in the 1930s.
Right. Marissa's holding it down.
Yeah.
In the 2007s.
Yeah, he walked off the set of Gone with the Wind and said, right. I'm not working for a plug nickel, no more.
Never again.
I want health insurance and someone to pay for my false teeth, and that was it. So she's bemoaning, and I say bemoaning, that actually is a bad, because that seems like I don't agree with her. But she says she's talking about the plight of Asians in cinema, that they're like... if you think about it, that they have very limited roles, like maybe more so than any other ethnic subtype in America, that they just have this lane and almost no one ever gets them out of it. And at one point, Nathan Fillion's like, well, why didn't you cast yourself as Penny? Mm-hmm. And she goes on and talks about this like, well, that's just never. But I'm like, that's kind of a really good question. Why didn't you cast yourself as Penny? You're a good singer. You wrote all the music. You wrote all the numbers. Mm-hmm. You are conventionally attractive. In that kind of same nerdy lane that Felicia Day is, why didn't she cast herself as that?
It's a good question.
They just did it for fun to release on the internet and you know, essentially pass the time while the writer's strike was happening. I felt like the song really didn't answer that.
Yeah, that's fair. I've read one other account that suggested it might have been more than that, that it was about, like, proving that you could do something outside of the typical studio pipeline, I guess.
Yeah.
And that it would be a big success. And and in that case, I guess you don't cast someone that people aren't familiar with. You go and you cast, like, the hottest nerd around. And I don't mean hot, like, physically. I mean hot, like, career-wise.
Right.
Like, she's blowing up.
Like, if you're trying to sell something as a web series and you have this actor who is the writer, director, star of a smash hit web series, The Guild, then there you go.
And everybody for years has been raving about her.
Right,
you know?
And you get Doogie Howser and the Nazi from Starship Troopers.
Right.
And you put him as Dr. Horrible, and then you cast the star of Firefly. And yeah, I guess it's... Yeah. But, yeah, no, that's actually an unassailable argument. I still think, like, you had... But isn't that kind of weird that... She was the one that had the creative control, and she made a decision to cast the conventionally attractive white girl.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because
you don't want to take too big of a risk if we're trying to prove the point that you can be successful outside the mainstream. So let's not cast the pretty Asian girl who can sing.
No, it's super weird. It's like, you know, casting Scarlett Johansson as the Ghost in the Shell lead, right? Like,
right.
Well, she's super marketable. Okay, well, is that true to what you're doing here? You know, is that telling your story? I don't know. It's interesting. I do find, you know, this is self-evidently true if you watch movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how many times have you seen people on the screen who are supposed to be Asian that are, like, Latino or Indian or some other nationality, right?
Sure.
And they're made up to look like they're Asian or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's so ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't happen nowadays, but what you still see is a lot of...
I look
of
at,
rampant...
like, Big Trouble in Little China. I think that the worst examples of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think the 80s might be, like, peak... Because you had the Short Circuit, the Johnny Five Indian guy,
Jesus,
who's
right.
just a straight-up white guy. And
it's a guy from Hackers, yeah.
Until Kumail Nanjiani was talking about that in Harmontown, I had no idea.
Right.
And I recently got Short Circuit because I wanted to show Jack.
Uh-huh.
And oh, my God, it's amazing. But yeah, there was a lot of – now, so we don't see much of that nowadays, although Scarlett Johansson, Ghost in the Shell, is a – certainly a potential type of that, or you've got Matt Damon and the Great Wall of China thing,
right? And then a lot of people Tom Cruise as the Last Samurai.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people. Well, that's part of the plot. It's like, okay, but that doesn't address the main argument. That's right. the whole cultural appropriation idea is all about.
Yeah,
but you get a lot, I guess, more tokenism where
right,
you got a mysterious businessman cast to get Ken Watanabe in there because that seems like something he would do.
Yeah.
Or we need a physician at a hospital. It's Asians; they're good at that. Or that's literally the song. She goes through all the different roles that are cast as Asians.
Yeah, no, and it only works for me because everybody is so self-aware about what they're writing because this has the potential to be super offensive.
Right.
And it's comedy. It's satire, right? So it's not supposed to be taken seriously. When they do the keyboards with this stereotypically traditional Chinese, I was like, oh, my God, are you kidding me?
Right, and she for comedic effect, gets her R's and L's confused.
But she's easily the best singer in the whole cast and crew, in my opinion. I think she's better than MPH. Yeah.
Wow. Huh. Okay. When I was listening to the commentary, it was the first time I'd heard it, so I wasn't concentrating on the performances. I was just like, kind of like trying to figure out the lyrics and what they're actually talking about.
My other favorite song on the commentary of the musical is Steve's song at the very end. It's after the reprise of commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, only works because everybody's on board with it, including Steve.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially a song that is a long string of S's. That this guy who can't say S's properly or has a horrible lisp is forced to say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at one point they have him doing Susu Studio.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was hilarious, and kudos to him for being on board because he could be shy about that, but he's not.
It seemed like I don't know how good of friends these guys were out of real life, but it does seem like that everybody was on board with making fun of everything about everybody.
Yeah.
And like poking fun of everybody's issues and stuff, and like that, I feel like that's something you could do if you're close friends. But that's like
Nathan Fillion making fun of how good looking and charming he is, right?
Yeah,
real tough. Nathan
In fact,
Fillion.
Apparently he's got a mean 7-layer bean dip,
right?
Yeah. But also, like, I guess like because Felicia Day was playing up the fact that I don't know, like, I guess she came. Does she have a rep for being pretentious? Because I felt like that's the role she was playing, as like a pretentious actress trying to take herself seriously.
Yeah,
but also fangirling about NPH and Nathan Fillion.
I thought it was the opposite. Like the perception of her was that she was just this fangirl and that she wanted to be more than that, but she was having such a hard time in the face
of
Nathan
Fillion. So
she was saying,
I don't talk about my process just because if she did, she would just talk about how she was staring into their dreamy eyes. And,
right, yeah. I think so.
Okay, all right. I wasn't sure, quite
I wasn't
sure about
sure
that
either,
joke.
But
that's the thing. Like they're all playing very exaggerated versions of themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, good for you. Good for you, Steve.
The one song that I absolutely hated was Zach's Flavor, that rap song. I thought it was cringe-worthy.
A little cringy. And also,
super cringy.
I mean, what's the joke there? That he is the younger brother and he thinks all this stuff is lame and he's too cool for school, but he's secretly not?
I guess he's the cool one. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just didn't like the song.
You say it's terrible. It wasn't as bad as I was expecting. Like Neil Patrick Harris, when he tried to rap, that was
intentionally bad.
That was intentionally bad.
Yeah.
But I felt like it was well written and his flow wasn't terrible. It's just like the premise of it is like that he's just so edgy. So edgy, he cuts himself.
Yeah.
On his own edge. I didn't get it. Especially like because there's other joke is like I guess his brother's coming in like weren't you in this production, weren't you in that production? So it's like, wait a second, if you actually have a background in theater, then what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like you're trying to act like this stuff is lame. Then you get it.
And there's hints in there that he actually doesn't think it's that lame.
Right,
he thinks it's cool, and he's like, oh, whatever.
Right.
And then $10 Solo, I thought was pretty good until NPH jumped in, and then it became really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he's, you know, paying Joss more, and then, oh, suck shit, Joss wrote us a bucks. Duet. Yeah. And, like, we both got screwed, that sort of thing.
Right, right.
Did Joss you actually, is the real winner.
Did you synchronize this up with the actual thing? Because I
did, but I don't thought, know how closely it tracked.
Okay, because I didn't. I was listening to it out okay. of, because I'd watched the whole thing a bunch, and... it occurred to me when Felicia Day started talking about, she was singing about, like, oh, this is the time we're in the alley.
Mm-hmm.
They actually, and we ate Chinese food that wasn't from Chinatown, even though we were filming in Chinatown, which, like, that seems like a very Hollywood thing to do.
Yeah.
It occurred to me, like, oh, this actually, there, some of this stuff matches up with the stuff that's going on in the background.
It does, yeah. Like when they do the Nobody Wants to Be Moist song, that's when the Big Bang guy's on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, roughly it does.
Now, was that true that they, because that's the other thing I guess I didn't understand is, like, when he came in and did that song, did he actually have a song that they cut?
Oh, I don't know.
Because
maybe.
Thoughts like because I was with him when they're talking about a cut song. I'm like, why would it be cut? Like, unless it just sucked.
Yeah.
Like, and then he made the point. And it's like, yeah, I guess it didn't have time for your internet time slot. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's just a joke. Maybe it's just a joke. They need a commentary to explain the stuff that's like real and the stuff that's make believe.
Yeah, it was hard to pull like what would be sincere and what wasn't out of that.
Yeah, I think I do feel like that they sincerely believe that the tokenism with Asian Americans is bullshit, and that the writer's strike was ultimately misguided and maybe not successful, and Joss does have some misgivings about his creative process and how the fans interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that stuff is all, but everything about, you know, that, you know, Neil and Nate are like had this rivalry, and that Felicia Day's got her head up her ass, and I wasn't sure how much Joss being the morose one was a joke and how much of it was actual, you know, based in fact. But it's like I said, it's an interesting way to do this kind of thing.
It is, yeah, and entertaining.
The last thing that I want to talk about is the writer's strike itself.
Okay.
And how Joss seems like he has a pretty pessimistic view of that. And I follow that pretty contemporaneously, because it was a big bugaboo with like the podcast I listened to, Bill Simmons. He was he's a member of the Screenwriters Guild of America, and because he did writing for Jimmy Kimmel, and he's a writer himself, and he had a lot of friends that are in writing room, and he was like constantly having them in every week and giving them updates and stuff. And also he's also really big in, like, anytime there's a sports strike, it's like he's personally interested in anytime where you've got talent. That's, you know, like he likes to frame it as like anytime you've got millionaires against billionaires is kind of interesting. The Writers Guild is not even that. You've got like thousandaires, like something like the very top. And that's the other thing, is like the sports league, Peyton Manning and Tom Brady striking is very different than the third string safety on, you know, an unsuccessful NFL franchise.
Yeah.
And that it seems like that striking is this very altruistic thing, because most of the people who are not mega famous are going to lose more money by not working during the strike than they'll ever earn back in their lifetimes with the sweeter deal that they're negotiating. They're essentially laying down their financial security or their earning power so that future generations can benefit in the long run.
Sure. Okay.
But that sucks, because you've essentially, what Hollywood did as a response is, you know what, we're just going to cram reality television down Americans' throat, and we bet they love it. And they did.
Yeah.
They did.
Some of them did.
Well, right. I mean, like, it's not like televisions were just blank. It wasn't
no,
like...
No, tons of people watched.
Reality. Yeah. So it's like, anytime the big guy... And also, like, I guess it was interesting 10 years ago, because Hollywood is like, you know, this streaming thing is going to be such a flash in the pan, and who knows how you're going to assign a value to it. And, you know, do you guys really want to and in these last 10 years, the biggest thing in all of Hollywood is probably streaming.
Yeah.
It's had the biggest impact.
And it's obviously going to be bigger in the future.
And these insiders had to know that. And it just seems like really immoral to try to screw these people out of those profits and make them strike in the first place.
Yeah.
We almost had another Writers Guild strike this year. We actually had an Empire business that we had recorded where we're going to talk about how we dealt with it, because that could really, you know, that really disrupts scripted television when that happens. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't following the issue quite as close this time because it actually didn't happen. So I don't know what the issues were and what the Writers Guild won from the threats and all that. But it just seems like every time there's a strike, the people that lose are the fans and the working stiffs. Because the people who are making films and television and producing that stuff are already rich and have a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get paid for 6 months or so, who cares?
They'll just take a vacation to Belize or something.
Or they'll run, you know, Big Brother Island, the third celebrity edition.
Oh, I think you meant like the rich people who get rich writing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. It's like Joss Whedon takes $200,000 of his own money and makes Dr. Right. Horrible sing-along blog, which he is quoted as saying that he made more for Dr. Horrible than he did for directing the Avengers.
Sure. I buy it.
So, I mean, that's a sucky situation. That's a sucky situation. It's almost like a soldier dying to preserve the idea of freedom back at home.
Like, yeah.
Thanks for doing that, guy. We'll build a statue for it to you.
Totally, that sucks. On the other hand, you know, kudos to Joss Whedon for taking what could have been a net negative for himself and turning it into a positive.
Yeah.
He turned that into an opportunity, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to make it seem like I didn't like, because it's like, I feel like, you know, you spend your own money however you want, and if you're a creative person, I understand that that's not exactly something you can just opt out of doing.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could try to do something completely out of the system and have complete creative control would be exciting for him. So I didn't mean it to come as a shot against Joss. It's just I can see him being kind of morose about that subject, because it's one thing that they're essentially forced to do it because of these one-sided deals that weren't taken account of any changes in technology. But, you know, the vast majority just lost a half year's of pay or more.
Yeah, no, he was a lucky one, right?
Right.
He had already built up enough of a career and was highly paid enough to where the strike wasn't going to kill him.
And you think about, it's not even just a writer's, right? It's like, think of all the grips, the photographers, the makeup people, the set designers, the costumers. Yep. Those people are sitting there idle too because they're not needed. And they have to kind of show solidarity. I don't think there was a lot of solidarity. It seems like there was a lot of you know, people grumbling, complaining about, like, you know, you guys are holding out for these percentages and you're like really fucking us really hard.
Yeah. And you're destroying heroes.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. There was a lot of, like, the reason that the first season of Breaking Bad is half as long as the others is because it's the writer's strike.
Yeah.
But that is kind of modern society in a microcosm, right? Like, if you already have money, life is awesome.
Yep.
If you don't have money and you're trying to get money, life is very hard. It's you are ice skating uphill.
That's how it goes. That is the way our society's set up.
Yep. And what do you do to fix it? I say we turn it all over to Dr. Horrible.
All right. Cool.
And he literally can't do worse.
Can he freeze me for like 200 years? I'd like to see what the future's like.
Yeah, he could stop your world.
All right, cool.
So you can see what it's the 2020s are all about.
Yeah, 2200s.
2200s.
Yeah. I'll see what the 2020s are all about, I hope.
I guess so. You're right. I fucked that up like I do. Anything else you want to talk about, Dr. Horrible?
Nope, I think
Dr.
that's it.
Dr. Horrible-ish. All right, thanks again, Tyler, for commissioning this podcast. It was a lot. I haven't seen this in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought it was interesting because I've seen how little these people have all aged. Like, I just saw Felicia Day.
Visually,
like, sure. She does not look appreciably older. Neil Patrick Harris still looks like Neil Patrick Harris. I haven't seen Nathan Fillion in a while. But what shocked me is how kind of old Nathan Fillion looked in this.
Yeah, yeah. I guess he was born in 71, which would make him
45.
Yeah, 45.
Because I was born in 76 now. And I'm 40 for another month or two.
Yeah. So like 35, 36 in this.
Yeah. I feel like the Nathan Fillion might have like popped out of the womb at 35 and he'll just stay there.
Until he's 65.
Yeah, until he's 65 and then God knows what'll happen.
Then the spell will be revoked broken. And yeah.
All right, that's it for Dr. Horrible. Thanks again, Tyler. The next one, I believe, is Master and Commander, Far Side of the World.
Oh, boy.
Top 10 favorite movie for me. I've watched it 12 to 20 times. Very excited. I have a lot to say. It was a community commission. I know that, so there'll be a lot of other opinions and insights. But I'll be damned if you have an original thought that I haven't already come up with, because I'm a huge fan. So yep. You got that coming.
And I've never seen it, so it should be an interesting
cast.
Really?
I thought you saw it once.
I don't think so.
Okay. Are we going to watch this one together?
Can we
watch it together?
Yeah.
I promise.
I won't
stare at you the whole time.
I just
be there to provide.
I have a feeling that you're going
to
be like in the background, like putting in appropriately dramatic music, hoping I'll like try to pump me up.
Nope. It doesn't need it. I'm just going to sit on my hands and not react. And just if you have questions, if you'd like to know more. I'll be there. So,
but I'll be saving those for the podcast.
Gotcha. All right, we will be back with Master and Commander at some time in the future. Please, and I hope you enjoyed
this
Dr.
One,
Horrible.
Maybe.
I've fucked up the outro. We're out. We'll see you later.